Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Business news, views, and insights from across the globe.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Hidden Growth Champions, our podcast series. Today in our studio, I've got a very special guest, Louis Carstens. Louis, thank you for making time for our conversation. You've had an illustrious career as you've climbed Mount Everest and a few other peaks. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Good morning, Saul. Thank you very much for hosting me. It's my honor and my privilege. So you mentioned Mount Everest. Big passion of mine is high altitude mountaineering. So part of my identity, if you will, is I am a mountaineer. I'm also a psychologist and I'm also a strategist. Career perspective, kind of a 50-50 split at this stage between working in big corporates across Africa and Europe at Exco level and other senior levels, but also many years in management consulting, both global management consulting and more your entrepreneurial local consulting firms. So a bit of everything career-wise, bit of everything in terms of my professional identity, and I'm definitely not a one-trick pony where I say I'm only a strategist or only a consultant. I embrace the diversity of the challenges that came my way over the last 25 odd years of my career.
That's fantastic. I mean, it's such an interesting mix, and I'd love to hear how you bring those different disciplines, those different perspectives together. I'm sure there's an amazing story or a few behind that one. Louis, just to kind of start off and kind of bring our audiences kind of into our conversation, this is kind of an ongoing conversation we've had for a while now. When we spoke about what does it mean to be 100% in, I can certainly imagine when you think about mountaineering, being 100% in is a very clear and specific meaning to it. But it also must have a very clear meaning when you're sitting in the boardroom and making some fundamental decisions that affect people's lives. It's the same when we think about our societal obligations, our family. So maybe talk to me a little bit about your perspective around what does being 100% in really mean?
So it's a really good way to start our conversation. I think that the principle, the concept of being 100% in is nothing new. I have a deep interest in sport psychology, in human potential and human performance. So I have read case studies, books about world-class sport people, world-class business people. And it always seemed to me that 100% is the commitment that you need to make if you want to do really big things in life. But bringing it closer to the boardroom, as you said, for me as a strategist, and I think most people will agree that strategy is all about being grounded in good strategic choices. I don't think anybody will be surprised with this principle. And intuitively, all of us know what a good strategic choice really is. For example, we know that a statement like we will be customer centric is really not a good strategic choice, because the opposite of that is, we will not be customer centric. And I can't think of any organization who will then embrace that. So intuitively, as business people, we know what a good strategic choice really is. And in the boardroom, it's all about engaging your brain and your heart at 100%. And never to let fear hold you back, because fear is debilitating. And I can tell you a story to emphasize what I mean with this 100% in at the boardroom. A few years ago, a client asked me to do a piece of work where he was the CEO, he wanted to know whether this business should go into international markets. So his request to me was, Louis, please do a piece of work and tell the board, do we need to internationalize? I then pushed back on that. because my view was that there's no piece of work that can ever be done to tell any client, any CEO, that he or she needs to internationalize. So I reframed it and I played it back to the CEO and I said to him, I can't do this work for you because you first need to tell me you've made the decision to internationalize, and then I can do the work to help you choose the markets where you go into. And there's a fundamental difference, Sarg, between these two options. The one is the option A, which is do a piece of work and tell me if we need to internationalize. For me, that's hedging a bit. I think it's good to have a plan B, but a plan B is really bad if it works against your plan A. Plan A is we have made the strategic choice to compete in international markets. Now let's figure out where these markets are. That is good strategy. This is what 100% means. When somebody says, do a piece of work to tell me whether we need to go into international markets, that for me is not 100% in. That is something that says to me, I'm going to let the data inform that. Now, I am absolutely data-driven and I love data, but you can't manipulate data to kind of anchor a plan B and a plan A. You need to be clear. I want to go international. Now let's look at the data. Where do we need to go into? And I think that so often we sit in boardrooms and we are engaging our brains 100% at a cognitive level, at a rational level, but we don't really always believe in what we do. For example, most people will agree, most executives will agree that strategy execution is a lot more difficult than strategy formulation. That's the truism out there, but I question that. I think strategy implementation is easy once you are committed. I think why companies globally struggle with strategy execution is because we want to move from intent to action. That path is not linear. You need to move from intent to decision to action. Then strategy execution makes sense. So for me, this thing about 100% in as executives, as board members, it's about fully embracing this principle of 100%. And let me quickly, Sar, tell you another story about one of the best decisions I've ever made to demonstrate 100% in, because we all are career people, right? So a few years ago, I was interviewing with two global management consulting firms. And I started at the same time, and progress was made more or less at the same pace in these two firms. Until one day, I picked up a brochure in the one firm, and the brochure had the following tagline. It said, "We are a bunch of optimists wanting to change the world." And I knew this is the kind of place where I can be 100% in. I went through the interview process, and the last interview was on a Sunday afternoon with the regional director from London at the Hyatt Hotel here in Rosebank. And in the meeting, 4 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon, he said to me, "Louis, we have decided that we will be making you an offer." I responded and I said, "I will accept the offer." He then responded by saying, "But you do not know what we are going to be offering you." I responded and I said, "It doesn't matter. I want to work for this firm." And these stories, Saul, is about 100%. Now, I'm not saying that I've always been 100%, but I do know that 100%, also from a mountaineering perspective, is the difference between success and failure. And the last story I quickly want to tell is, you mentioned in the introduction that I summited Mount Everest, and that is correct. But I only summited on my second attempt. On my first attempt, I got to 8,400 meters. I had another 4 hours to climb, let's say another 450 meters to the summit, and I turned around. Now, I was sick. There's no question about that. I was sick. I wasn't as strong as I wanted to be. But in hindsight, I also thought that maybe I just wasn't 100% in. And that particular expedition was on TV as part of the Discovery series. And I remember getting back to Camp 2 after I turned around, and I was interviewed by Discovery Channel, and they asked me, Louis, will you ever come back to Mount Everest? And I said, no. I said, I won't come back. I've climbed to 8,400 meters. I'm happy with my performance. I gave it my best shot, so I won't be coming back. 2 days later, walking out of base camp back to Lukla, I realized that I haven't given Everest 100%. And I realized that if I walk away now, it will haunt me for the rest of my life. I came back the next year and I summited Mount Everest. So my experience as a consultant, as an exco member of listed companies, as a mountaineer, 100% for me is the benchmark. It's for me that clear, so.
It's a great, great story. Louis, I just want to, the importance of being 100% in is really palpable. It comes out through the stories you've shared with us. And I want to spend a bit of time there. But just before we go there, there's something that you've said that triggered a thought in my mind. And that is, what happens before we commit? What happens before we arrive at the realization that we want to be 100% in, that we will be 100% in? And that leads me to something that we speak a lot in our team about, which is dilemmas. You know, we don't commit fully to things that are easy. We don't commit to things that are obvious, you know, good customer choice versus bad customer choice. We commit to things where there's more than one possible solution, where it really, really matters because you really weigh the options here. And there isn't at the outset, you know, that patently obvious decision. Otherwise, everyone would do it, right? It would be, you just follow the herd. You've decided to do something that is different, something that is important, and you've actually given it some thought. And their strategic thinking really matters. As you said, it's not just about the execution of the patently obvious, you know, achieving benchmarks, you know, adopting good practices. Here we're talking about something doing something that is extraordinary. And to do something that's extraordinary, we really need to understand the choices that are involved and inherently the dilemmas that they present. And the best example I could give to this is I was watching an interview with one of the founding members of Uber, and everyone were kind of expecting, you know, the usual, you know, here's a great story, and they started in their living room and you know, they kind of scaled up without any effort, and it just kind of all the stars aligned. But he actually spoke about something very different. The entire interview, he spoke about those difficult choices, those multiple choices that were in his head, the deep thinking he was applying to things that we just kind of take as obvious. There's an app, you press a button and off we go. And he just gave such a palpable sense of how important deep strategic thinking is, how those choices are not just patently obvious. And when we commit because we know, and it really makes sense having deeply thought about the options and their implications. Does that make sense? Does that come up in your work as well?
Sorry, it does. So for me, my experience, be it as a mountaineer, be it as a strategist, psychologist, one of the things I fundamentally believe in is that choices have got sacrifices. And without the principle of sacrifice entering the conversation about a choice, I think we are only scratching the surface. If you want to achieve these big things, whatever your vision is, and you know, my vision will be different to yours, and I think that's good. But I love what you said about this interview you listened to, and it wasn't the typical thing about starting the garage and all of that, you know. And I often wonder how true those stories actually are. But I think there's this realization about strategic conversation that when we talk about choices, and again, choices for me underpin the work we do as executives, irrespective of industry, irrespective of whether you're a not-for-profit or a profit organization, irrespective if you list it or not, choices is what executives get paid to do. So the first thing for me is a choice must be linked to changing a performance curve. If a choice does not change a performance curve, what's the point? Really, what's the point? I'm, for example, Saar, personally, I'm absolutely against the principle of a job description for senior executives. I can't see the point. I really can't see the point of a job description for an EXCO member or for a BU leader or whatever, because the job of a senior executive is to change performance curves. That's the foundation. When you want to change a performance curve, you need to make good choices about what you want to do and what you don't want to do. And then you need to understand that to make a good choice that will change a performance curve will lead to a sacrifice. And that's a crucial principle. And I think so often we talk about strategy and business performance, and we, in our minds, we look at all of these things as linear. It's a linear process. It's linear progress. It's step one, step two, step three, you know. And that's not the way business works. It's about the sacrifice. And the same thing in mountaineering. When I didn't summit Everest in 2009 on my first attempt, and I came back and I realized if I do things for my second attempt on Mount Everest, the way I did things for my first attempt, in all probability, the outcome will be the same. So if we as executives want a different outcome, we need to do things differently. So for my second attempt on Everest, for an entire year, and I'm not exaggerating, I trained every week for 5 days a week. I trained the way I thought I need to train. I didn't have apps telling me how to train. You know, today there's an app for everything. I didn't have an app. I didn't have apps to tell me how long my recovery period should be. I didn't have apps that monitored my maximum heart rate and average heart rate and calculated my fitness levels. I just trained because I knew I need to make a sacrifice. For an entire year, I didn't have a single beer. And believe me, I like a beer. No alcohol for an entire year. My family would organize events with friends for a Sunday afternoon. I couldn't make it. Why not? Because I'm training. I'm at Sacred Bos hiking with a 25-kilogram backpack. So this thing about whether it's Uber or any startup or, you know, any form of going for big things in life, it's about the relentless focus on the choice and embracing the sacrifice. You said it yourself a few minutes ago. If everything was easy, everybody would be doing it. So what's the future of differentiation, in my opinion, for businesses? It's truly about having the conversations about the choices and understanding what a good choice is. I remain intrigued and curious about how organizations can say customer centricity is an objective. How can it be an objective? Because doesn't then imply that if you don't have it, you're not customer centric. It makes no sense. Yes. Customer centricity is management or leadership 101. So this principle of we want to do big things, vision. I'm a passionate believer in vision and everything that goes with vision. But again, vision for me is a conversation. It's not a five-step action plan to get to vision. It's the conversation. So you have the vision. You've got the ambition. You've got the desire to do something. You need to make good choices. Then you identify those choices, and then you test those choices. And a choice that doesn't have a sacrifice embedded in executing on that choice, I would argue, Saar, I don't think that's a good choice, and I don't think it will make any difference whatsoever. That, for me, is steady as you go, more of the same. You want to do big things as an individual, as an organization, as an exco, as a leadership team, make those choices, and then test each choice for the level of sacrifice in executing on that choice. That for me is the magic that that's there for the taking.
Mm. Louis, let's talk for a moment about what, when you realize there's sacrifices involved and you now have committed yourself to a choice, fully cognizant of the implications, what happens? And it goes really to the core of why this is so important, why this concept of being 100% in really, really matters. Maybe talk to us about what happens once you commit. What are the kind of things that you see shift or change as a result of this process? When you reach that point, when you realize we are actually committing to this, this is no longer just a conversation towards an exploratory discussion, we are actually making a commitment to a strategic choice. What happens then? What are the kind of things that come into play once that commitment takes place?
That is a really great question, Saul. And for me, what I have seen and personally experienced, it's all about, and this is almost counterintuitive. It's really counterintuitive. It is changing the paradigm from we to I. It's about personal accountability and owning the entirety of personal accountability. I have seen how an entire leadership team can shift fundamentally if each and every person around the table takes personal accountability. It's so easy today to, and don't get me wrong, team is important. There's no question about it. You know, as a mountaineer, I have a huge dependency on teams. And as a consultant and as an EXCO member, but it's so easy to make the team the collective accountability owner.
Hmm.
I think there's place for that. But coming back to your question about what have I seen, not what have I been taught at business schools or what I read in books. For me, the shift happens when you look at yourself in the mirror and you confront yourself and you shift the paradigm from us as a team to me and what I need to be accountable for as a member of this team. And unless that shift takes place, I don't think a team can succeed. Because if we make the team the accountable unit of analysis, we can almost outsource our accountability and say it is the team. It's the team that did this, right?
Yes.
Whereas if we stick with it's me, what have I learned? I think that's when the shift happens. And again, a quick story here. Aconcagua is the highest mountain in South America. It's one of the seven summits, and I've been very fortunate to have climbed the seven summits, which is the highest mountain in each continent. But on my first attempt on Aconcagua, it's just under 7,000 meters, I failed. I didn't get up, right? Now, mountaineers are world famous for finding excuses for why we don't summit. And there's almost like a series of excuses we use. You know, we either say, I mean, the most famous excuse for not summiting is, oh, the weather was bad, right? Mm-hmm. The second one is, oh, you know, my guide was bad. The third one is, oh, you know, the person I used for the weather forecast, they got the weather forecast wrong. So there's a range of excuses. And I use those excuses. So when I didn't summit Aconcagua in Argentina in the Andes the first time.
I have to say, there must be an app for that, right? Or a guide for the mountaineer's list of excuses for why not, right?
Correct. It's like we go to finishing school, right? So I came back after I didn't summit the first time, and I blamed the fact that I got sick, because that's also a world-famous excuse. Oh, I got sick. Now, sometimes you do get sick and you don't summit. But I know that that was just an excuse. I went back the second time, sorry, and again, I didn't summit, right? So now two attempts on Aconcagua, I didn't summit. The second time I didn't summit, my excuse was that, my guide got sick and therefore I didn't summit. And I say this in my mountaineering talks that I do for businesses. I was then confronted with a fundamental choice for me in mountaineering. And by the way, in life, as in all my roles as well. And the truth was that I was the problem. Me, Louis Carstens, I was the problem. And I was faced with a fundamental choice. And these two options in this choice were mutually exclusive. I could either start working hard and succeed, or I can keep on doing the minimum and keep on failing and being mediocre. And that was what I was confronted with. Do I want to succeed and work for that? Or do I want to just doing the minimum to get by and I'm going to be mediocre for the rest of my life? Now, what's mediocre for me is not mediocre for you. It can't be. It's your personal internalization of this. And I am not at all ashamed to admit this to you, the audience today, and in my mountaineering talks, that I was the problem for failing twice on Aconcagua. But I'm also very proud to say that Aconcagua taught me the most valuable lesson in life, which is take personal accountability. And that's what I did. So circling back to you know, your question about what happens, the shift for me, my personal experience, what I've seen in businesses is, yes, team is important, but we also need to shift the paradigm from we to I. It's counterintuitive. Everybody talks about from I to we. I have a bit of a different point of view. And I'm not underestimating the power of from I to we, or from me to us. But success and achievement and 100% is from we to I. I own the outcome. I am personally accountable. That's the shift, Sor.
You know, Louis, it kind of really brings home for me the, you know, we often speak about insights that we generate through a transition, through either transforming ourselves, our organizations, sometimes entire industries. And very often, you know, the insights in the shift from I to we, what we discover when it's the focus shifts and not just about me and my business unit and et cetera. But what you're raising is an equally important point, which is the shift from we to I has a whole host of insights in it as well. Yes. And then we often forget about that. It's almost like we feel we've arrived. We made the shift from I to we, and therefore we're there. What you're highlighting to us is how important it is to bring it back home to I, bring it back home to what am I going to do? What will my contribution be? Where do I fit in? How do I make this work? And that's often, that's where it comes back home. That's where we can't hide anymore.
And so what you just said now is important, where you realize that you can't hide anymore. It is easy to hide when the paradigm is from individual to team. We, the team, the team's accountable. It's easy to hide. When we say we're a bunch of high-performing individuals in a team, climbing mountains, climbing K2, climbing Mount Everest, there's no place to hide. You get caught out.
Yes.
And sometimes when that happens, we need to move on. We need to go and do other things, do other stuff. Yes. So I like what you said about when you shift also from we to I, and when you put up your hand and you say, this is what I'm accountable for, then there's no place to hide.
Mm. Louis, let's talk a little bit about why this is important in today's world. You know, when we start to think about, you know, we've always applied it in personal life, in organizations, and as organizations have grown, we had multiple opportunities along our career to apply this principle. But now when we see the social shifts that are taking place, when we see movements appearing, when we see organizations having to relate to society differently, when it's no longer about CSI and doing things on the side, but we need to bring elements of sustainability into the core of our business, where we have to question why are we here? What is our contribution? What value do we really generate? The principle of being 100% in, how does it play out beyond the boardroom, beyond this kind of strictly clear lines of an organization, into the extended enterprise, into the broader industry, and into society, where there are other players that are also trying to apply this principle?
So I don't think there's just one answer to a really good question that you're asking. And I think different people will answer this question differently. And the way I look at it is, there's no question that the world is changing. And it almost sounds a little bit so what to say that. But, and it's not only the pandemic that's forcing us to think differently about things. There's a whole bunch of things, you know, there's there's new social groupings, there's the millennials in our businesses, you know, there's a bunch of social factors. And I like to bring it back to, and again, it's something that's not new, this thing about purpose. I think that that purpose will continue to, will truly be a big differentiator. So it's almost like, what do you stand for? You know, you talk about ESG, you talk about sustainability and these kind of things. You know, I'm a big supporter of the World Economic Forum and the work that they do. And you can see that they are driven by a purpose. I think what confuses things for us is we also live in a goal-driven society. And I'm a big believer in goals, but I've also seen how goals can lead us barking up the wrong tree. Purpose for me is the all-encompassing theme here. And if I look at, you know, in the societies that we're in, I was saying that, you know, I'm not sure if I came up with this, but it's the way I look at things. When a job feels like a job, you are in the wrong job. And I think it's such an important point. When we do what we do, and you know, on our desk we have our job description and our KPIs and you know, the performance management forms that must be filled out. Those things are important. There's no question about it, right? But purpose is more than this. For me, purpose is it's your calling. And the world that we're in today, we need people to really embrace their personal purpose. That spark, that thing that says, I can work 18 hours a day, not because I have to, not because I've got a tight deadline, but because it's worthwhile, it's meaningful. For me, the job that we do in organizations, that's outside in for me. That's goals. It's outside in. It's externalization. It's affirmation. I can tick the box. I've achieved the goal. I've made my sales target. Yes or no. I've exceeded my sales target by 10%, and therefore I get a bonus. If I exceed my sales target by 15%, I get a bigger bonus, et cetera, et cetera. These things are of the utmost importance. But there's a world where that's driven by goals, which is the outside in, it's extrinsic, it's affirmation. And I think that this world of just being goal-driven, in my definition, that is not the 100% world. That's a 90% world. The 100% world is where you think about contribution as opposed to affirmation. It's where you think about giving more than what you take as opposed to taking more than what you give. It's about inside out rather than outside in. And I want to be careful, Sarv, that I don't fall into, you know, a cheap rhetoric of pop psychology and walking through fire or walking on coals and these kind of things. You know, I don't believe in those things. I don't like it. But there's really something for me about contribution, about collaboration, about even competitors who can work together in the interest of society. You know, the pandemic now and the debate about vaccination versus not vaccination. You know, for me, we have a role to play as citizens, as global citizens. We have a role to play in terms of this pandemic, right? That's our contribution. That's how we leave the world a better place for our children, our grandchildren, and those who will come when we have long gone. We can't just take. At some stage in our lives, we've got to switch from taking more than what we give to giving more than what we take. And that, for me, is the exciting part of our conversation, is making that shift. It's not about, I want to contribute and therefore I give $100 a month to charity. That's great to do that. But taking personal accountability means more than that. So I'm a big believer that the business model that I was taught at university, so much of that is still relevant today. Businesses are there to make money. There's no question about it. And I'm not even remotely debating that. But I live my life personally, and I try to teach my kids that. And in my professional world, where the material part is the outcome, it's not the purpose, it's the outcome, it's the consequence. And I think that is also the challenging part for us as professionals, for us who are more experienced, to also coach and mentor others around this principle of giving more than what we take. We can't live our lives taking more than what we give. We just can't. Unfortunately, so much is actually anchored in that. I want to have the biggest bonus. I want to have a bigger bonus the more I perform. I have read some research where, you know, some very smart academics are saying, drop the principle of a bonus. Pay everybody a really good salary, right? Just a good salary. You don't need to do all this other stuff. Because when you bring the principle of a bonus in, you bring in internal competitiveness. That works against collaboration. So I think, Saab, this world that we're in today, where we can just give more than what we take. And even when I go and climb mountains, I was in Pakistan 2 years ago. I attempted K2, the second highest mountain in the world. I didn't make it. I didn't summit. But I even tried there to give more than what I take. I gave stuff. I gave stuff to the Hunzas in Pakistan. I gave away gear to people who needed more than what I needed. Somebody who really looked after me, I bought him a cell phone because he was working with a cell phone that he couldn't get access to his wife and children in the Pakistani village that he was. Now, I'm not special at all, not by a country mile, but I try to live this principle of giving more than what I take. And I think our leaders in businesses should do that, or at least have the conversation about what does it mean for us as an exco of a listed company that must create a certain level of ROA and ROE. What does it mean for us to give more than what we take? It is a fundamental conversation to have. I don't have the answer for you, Saab. I can only share with you how I look at this.
100%. Yeah, it reminds me, a couple of years ago, I had the pleasure of trekking down southern India. It's a place that's very special to me. And I remember on the last, I think it was the last day or just before the last day, hooked up with a bunch of cyclists in the city of Cochin, just right at the bottom tip. And one of them took me out to a tour at night of the city. Now, it's not something I would recommend to anyone, cycling at night in the condensed traffic of a major Indian metropolis, not for the faint of heart. But one of the things we did before we went out to the streets, we actually went out to a practice ground, and it was out by the countryside. And, this youngster was taking some advice, and we went through a few exercises. And I remember at the end, I left the whole kit with him, cleats, you know, and pedals and a few other items. This guy is now in his early 20s. He races internationally. He still, you know, sends me, you know, photos of him, you know, practicing with pros in Belgium and participating in major competitions. I mean, I have no doubt that the gear I left with him is probably long gone and unused. But it was just that few moments of thinking beyond yourself, helping a young individual who got excited about a sport and who was doing it in a really difficult neighborhood. Who is trying his best through the mayhem of traffic in that city to become something more. You know, for me, it never left me, that just what those few moments can do and how thinking of it from a contribution perspective makes a huge difference.
And that is it. It's making a difference to one person. I mean, it's not about changing the world. I mean, I can't change the world. I can't, even if I want to, but I can make a difference for one person. And it doesn't need to be all kind of, the soppy stories and all of it. You know, you can make a difference by giving your time to mentor somebody in your business on a Saturday afternoon. You know, you can go and volunteer at a university to mark papers or to help people who struggle with a certain subject. There's just so much. But the principle, sorry, is this thing about let's start conversation in our businesses as leaders about giving more than what we take. That's for me, what a good starting point.
100%. Louis, what advice would you give to leaders who are contemplating, who are listening to this conversation between us, who are thinking and pondering, what if I apply this principle of being 100% in? What if that becomes the operating model for me as an individual? What advice would you give them?
Probably saw three things. I think the first one is to do what I did when I failed twice on Aconcagua, which is look at yourself in the mirror and ask yourself in the privacy of your bathroom or wherever you are, am I 100%er or am I a 90%er? And you know, I think that's a starting point where you absolutely, you brutally honest about in this role, this position that I'm in today, my level of accountability and responsibility, am I 100%er or am I not? And it's not about, oh, you know, I'm a 95%er, I'm 5 years or 2 years from retirement, so I'm actually okay, Jack. That's not good enough, right? So I think that's the first thing. And you know, once you ask yourself the question, ask your boss, your peers, subordinates, ask them the question, do you think I'm 100%er? And then you ask them, and this is the challenging part, give me evidence that show I'm not 100%. And I think that adds a huge amount of creativity to the conversation for yourself. So instead of asking, give me evidence to show that I'm 100%, turn it around and ask, give me evidence that show that I'm not 100%. I think that's more creative and I think it's more rich in terms of what you can get. I think that's the first thing. I think that the second thing is making choices and decisions. I've had a long enough career to know that when you have people who are not really committed in a team, it just doesn't work. Yes. And more importantly, it's just not worth the effort. The conflict, the negative energy, because I can't motivate you. It's one of the first things, one of the few things I remember from university is one person cannot motivate another person. It's just not possible. So I can't motivate you when we're on the same team and say, Saad, you know what? You're a 50%er. You need to become 100%er. If you don't want to be 100%er, nothing in the world will get you there. No bonus, no incentive. And I just think that's a second thing that I would, the advice I would give to those who are listening is, if you yourself realize you're not 100%er, you need to make some tough calls. Because I don't believe that you can lead, anybody can lead in a business today, the world we're in, if you're not 100% in it. I just don't think it's possible. I think you will get found out. And if you have people in your team who are not 100%ers, I think in some parts of an organization, that's okay. I think it's naive to want to think everybody must be 100%er. That's not possible. But senior levels, exco levels, board levels, somebody's not 100%, it's just not worth it to engage with somebody at those levels who's not 100%er. And I've seen the destruction that can come from that. It's not worth it. So that's the second thing, make the tough calls. And the third thing is, it's as I, you know, alluded to that earlier, have the conversation. What we can't do is as the CEO go out and say to our exco members, thou shalt be 100%er. That's also naive. It's about the conversation. It's about understanding that we truly now talking about capturing the hearts of our people. And that starts right at the top. So those are the three things. Look at yourself in the mirror. Are you 100%er? Look at your team. Make choices and decisions about the non-100%ers. And thirdly, just start the conversation. And don't have the conversation and say, we're going to talk about it every Friday between 8 and 9 a.m. Talk about it whenever you can. Talk about it formally and informally. That's how we will change the culture in organizations. On this is through conversation.
And then Louis, my last question to you, what advice would you give to the young generation? I'm always conscious that, and particularly through this pandemic, of how we became more humble, how the young generation has engaged us in conversation and some really challenging questions about things that we have to admit we don't have the answer for, and we should. So what advice would you give to the young generation, the ones who are just entering the workforce, the ones that are kind of looking up and saying, you know, do I adopt this principle? Do I adopt it early? What can I learn from those who've walked the path towards purpose in their career? What advice would you give to those individuals?
So firstly, I absolutely agree with you. I think that this younger generation has had such a material impact in the world today, not only the world of business, in the world generally. And I applaud them. There's just no question about it. I think that in my experience, the organizations that I've worked in, am working in, will be working in, the role that these the young people of today, the ones who are starting out, the role that they play and what they are bringing to the table in terms of the conversation, I applaud them. Mm-hmm. It's not always been comfortable, but I applaud them. So again, three bits of advice. The first one is constructive and positive authenticity. And there's three parts of that to that. The one is take but also give, speak but also listen, teach but also learn. So there's something for me around, you're a young person, you're starting out, be authentic. But there's just for me two qualifiers. Be constructive in your authenticity and be positive in your authenticity. The second one is to take risks. I look at these MBA studies overseas, the Ivy Leagues, the best MBAs, where do they go and work and those businesses and the salaries that they get paid. And it's really wonderful if you can land those jobs. But my advice to those starting out will be always take the more exciting opportunity first before you just chase money. I think that chasing money from early on in your career, I think it's a slippery slope and I think it's a path of compromise. And it will be very difficult for you to come back from that path of compromise if you measure your efficacy in your career based on the money that you earn. My advice will be, assess the efficacy of your career based on the exciting opportunities. Even if you fail, that's absolutely okay. So embrace failure, like I did on Aconcagua and the mountains that I failed on. Embrace failure, learn from that, become a better person. And the third part is, I think we live in this world, you know, social media and all the glamour and TV programs and all of that. And I want to say to these people just starting out, this young generation, I want to say to them that building a career, it's not the glamour that we see on TV and on social media. Building a successful career is complex. It's difficult. It's very hard work with morals and values embedded in that. And lastly, it's about the long game. It is really about the long game. As a strategist, I believe in the long game. And I wish somebody would have said to me when I started my career that, Louis, you need to play the long game, because I did not always play the long game. I wish I had, but I've got no regrets because I've learned so. And that's why I can say to the young generation today, when you make career choices, when you have two or three offers, think about the excitement in the opportunity and think about the long game. So this will be my advice for the young generation.
Louis, thanks for a great conversation. It was wonderful having you in our studio and learning from your experience and your perspective about being 100% in. I'm sure we'll speak again soon. And thanks again for making the time.
Thank you, Saul. Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Join us next time for more business news, views, and insights from across the globe.